Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two interviews up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the author Paul Street on the Tea Party, the dismalness of the Dems, and the fitness of Obama's personality for that dismalness. And at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Cordelia Fine, a psychologist and author of a fantastic book called Delusions of Gender, on how all that stuff you hear about the biological basis of differences between men and women is just a boatload of nonsense. Before all that, some words in the economic news, all euro crisis today. I never thought I'd be saying this, but it must be conceded that Angela Merkel has a point or two. Not the way that the German chancellor and many of her fellow Germans want to drive Greece, Ireland, and the other troubled countries in the periphery of Europe through the austerity wringer, but in some other matters. Merkel thinks that bondholders should take a hit, and they should. Budgets are being savaged and millions thrown out of work on the outer edges of Europe so that bondholders can remain largely unscathed. Ireland is pouring enormous resources into saving its busted banks. An economy can't survive the demise of its banking system, but putting every euro into the effort and starving everything else to fund it is insane and cruel. So far, bank investors have taken some haircuts, as they say in the trade, but they're not getting clipped enough. Germany wants to see bondholders take some more, and why not? Whenever the subject comes up, investors panic and dump bonds of the risky countries, which causes worry warts to predict imminent doom. But austerity also causes investors to panic, because when economies implode, tax revenues wither, and budget deficits get wider. Austerity is a credit risk, too. Another point that the Germans and other European countries have, the Irish corporate tax regime is a scandal. Taxes in corporations are very low, which has prompted a number of multinationals to set up shop there. That gives them access to an educated English-speaking workforce inside the European Union with a national tax rate of just 12.5%. Most other first-world countries tax corporate income at rates above 20%. But Ireland isn't just a comfy spot for a foreign multinational to set up shop. It's also a nice place to route money through. For example, as Bloomberg reported the other day, Google, with the permission of our IRS, has assigned much of its intellectual property rights to its Bermuda subsidiary, to which it pays license fees, fees that it can deduct from its income in high-tax countries. That Bermuda subsidiary, though, is officially set up as an Irish company. But since Google claims that the company's management is in Bermuda, it's largely exempt from Irish taxes. Google also routes most of its sales outside the U.S. through its Irish subsidiary, but thanks to that Bermuda trick, claims the Irish subsidiary makes almost no profit. And the money traveling from Ireland to Bermuda is routed through a Dutch subsidiary with no employees, allowing Google to shelter its income from Irish taxes. As a result of all this trickery, Google reduced its foreign tax rate to 2.4%, meaning that just about everyone listening to this pays a higher share of his or her income in taxes than Google does. This probably adds about $100 to Google's stock price, now around $600 a share. Many other tech companies, like Microsoft and Apple, perform similar maneuvers to reduce their taxes to a fraction of the rates that are on the U.S. law books. Nice for the companies, but what does this do for Ireland? The multinationals do provide some employment in Ireland, but it's of a very shallow sort. There's little research and development done in Ireland, or procurement of goods and services, meaning that there are no spillover developmental effects from the multinationals' investments. So the boom that Ireland saw in the late 1990s and early 2000s was of a very superficial sort, and one that was turbocharged with a crazy housing bubble. When that bubble burst, there was little of substance beneath the froth. It is true that the multinationals have Ireland over a barrel. If the country does raise its corporate taxes, some of them will no doubt leave, costing the country jobs and revenues when it can little afford to lose either. But for longer-term health, it has to get off this economic crack. You can read this as Ireland's particular case of the pickle that many countries find themselves in. The whole neoliberal strategy of coddling capital has hit a wall, but no one has the imagination or political nerve to come up with a new strategy. Concerning the austerity wringer, I should bring forward a point made by the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis in our interview on last week's show. Over the last decade, Germany has really put the squeeze on its working class. Since 2000, productivity is up almost twice as much as pay. So too in the U.S., actually. But it's not true of the countries on the periphery of Europe. Italy, Portugal, and Spain have all seen wage growth outstrip productivity, And so too is Greece, probably, but there are no good statistics coming out of that country to confirm the impression. So it would be politically difficult for the German government to be seen as indulging the peripheral countries when it's spent so hard on its own population. This sure has been a great era for the capitalists of the world. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Paul Street. Some of Europa Endlos, Europe Endless in English, by Kraftwerk. Europe isn't looking quite as sleek these days as it was when Kraftwerk was pumping out all that great stuff. Paul Street is a prolific writer and commentator on U.S. politics. His latest book is The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power, published in September by Paradigm. He's now working on a book on the Tea Party with Anthony DiMaggio. Paul Street. Welcome, Paul.
Hi there.
So the Tea Party won a gigantic victory, or did they?
I think it's significant, actually. I think some of what I hear liberal circles on the left is unduly discounting what happened. It's true that Christine O'Donnell went down to defeat, and it's true that, was it Sharon Angel? Am I mispronouncing her name? Was defeated. These are more extreme members and variants that probably didn't have any chance of winning, but actually 40 of the 60... new Republican members of the House of Representatives were officially Tea Party candidates, according to the New York Times website analysis. Five of the six new senators technically speaking, Tea Party candidates, endorsed by Tea Party, had some Tea Party affiliations. And that doesn't even count the existing Tea Party caucus in Congress, which I think was 48. There were 48 people in the House. They considered themselves Tea Party Republicans. A lot of the ones that lost, the Tea Party candidates, were just symbolic protest candidacies in liberal districts where they had absolutely no chance. They had very little money. They weren't viable candidates. They weren't particularly serious. So actually the ones that were viable did pretty well, all things considered. And beyond the races where there were or were not Tea Party candidates too, the Tea Party was quite significant. In the exit polling data, I believe it was three or four Republican voters said they were supporters of the Tea Party movement. They identified them, so-called movement. They identified themselves with, quote-unquote, the Tea Party, which we can get to what that even is. And one thing that's interesting about that is that in the polling data that me and my co-author, Tony DiMaggio, were doing a book called Crashing the Tea Party, found is that the people who identified themselves as Tea Party supporters were highly motivated to vote in the midterm elections. And more than 90% of them identified themselves as Republicans. So while the Obama and the Democrats, with their cringing corporate captivity, are demobilizing their own so-called progressive base, the traditional Democratic constituency, these folks were they're part of the enthusiasm gap. The people who, for whatever reasons, identify themselves with the Tea Party, very highly motivated, A, to vote, and B, to vote for Republicans. So they had this whole Tea Party brand and phenomena and whatever you want to call it, how we want to understand, really mattered, even outside where there were any Tea Party candidates. So there's more to say about why they mattered. But that's
It's pretty funny. Back in election 2008, we were hearing how the Republicans were pretty much a dead beast. And this is, the Republicans are finished for a generation. They're going to have to go back and reinvent themselves. And here they are 2 years later with a remarkable resurrection.
I don't know if we want to say historic, and I think it's what the economic numbers would have indicated, these kind of numbers that they pulled off, but it's really quite extraordinary. Is it 60 or 61 in the House and 6 in the Senate? Those are the biggest numbers, biggest turnover in a midterm since 1948, I believe, or 46. The people were actually talking, liberals and even some Republicans were talking about a real 2008 as a realignment election. Democratic hegemony. They're talking about making New Deal analogies to 1932, a sweeping transformation of the party system, which I didn't think, the numbers of Obama's mandate was pretty big. It was 54%, and that's the biggest popular election victory for a president in a long time. This was not Bill Clinton squeaking in with help from Ross Perot in 1992. This was not George W. Bush winning an election at the Supreme Court. It was significant, and the Democratic majorities in both houses of the Congress were significant. If ever there was a moment for those liberals who want to believe that those stars have to align and then we can have progressive policy victories, that was it. And very little happened in a progressive kind of way, and now you can completely stick a fork in it for the next 2 years. It's just completely over.
I want to come back to the failures of the Democrats in a moment, but let's just talk a bit about the Tea Party some more. What are we to make of them? I think there's some people, liberal leftists, whoever, who regard them as like some sort of brown shirt movement. Are they frightful, or are they just a new version of some traditional republicanism? What's your reading of just?
I would go more with the latter, with a new traditional of traditional conservatism. Sort of, it's the paranoid style, the authoritarian McCarthyite paranoid version of the right that's sort of back in a way that's empowered in a way that it hasn't been, in more than 50 years. The brown shirt thing, I'd be very careful about. Very skeptical about that. People are throwing the word fascism and proto-fascism around in ways that I think are sometimes sort of disingenuous or just sort of ignorant. Maybe it's my background in history, but fascism to me is a very historically sort of specific formation, and it involves mass mobilization of sort of lower middle class elements in the streets as essentially thugs, among other things.
Against a genuine radical threat.
They're sort of, I always sort of agree with Trotsky's analysis of fascism. It was sort of a mass petty bourgeois riot against an organized and militant working class. We don't have an organized and militant working class for them to smash. The Tea Party is more neoliberal. And I've done some work, and we have a book coming out, Tony DiMaggio and I do, called Crashing the Tea Party. And we went to some of the meetings in the Chicago area, and they don't really feel like a social movement. They don't feel like any kind of mass movement at all. In fact, they seem kind of hostile, to the very notion of forming movements and street actions and all that. That's just not...
They're radical individualists.
Well, many of them are. They're quoting Ayn Rand, and there are some libertarians, particularly in the early stages of the Tea Party movement. They seem to have been swamped by sort of Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin types of people. I don't think we should be calling them fascists, but I do think there are some sort of proto-fascistic kind of aspects of their belief structure and the belief system which bother me a great deal, and which could, over time, with deepening economic crisis and terror attacks, become sort of seedbeds of something that's much scarier. But really, I think that I call the GOP now the TOP. The Tea Party people really are. They're like really loud, obnoxious, super Republicans. This is sort of where the Republican Party has been moving anyway. And my analysis of the Tea Party, to no small extent, is a top-down, astroturf, big money-funded attempt to rebrand the GOP, to make it, to increase voter turnout, to give it a new look and a new feel, so that the GOP could more effectively take advantage of the horrific economic numbers that any out-of-party power ought to be taking advantage of against an incumbent party amidst the kind of economic crisis we're in. I think they're quite effective in doing that. And they did it quite well, and they did it with great assistance from corporate media, and not just Fox News and talk radio, but from the New York Times and the Washington Post. And the person that had the Tea Party beat at the New York Times, Kate Zernicki, has consistently sold this thing as a movement, as if it were a popular grassroots.
She also has a book to sell on that, too.
And she has a book to sell on that, and it's one of the core theses of it. And she seems to have taken a lot of this analysis of it from some of the very elite Republican leaders and funders of it, like Dick Armey. It's amazing how many of the pieces of information that she quotes seem to come from the top down. That's what it is. It's making tea from the top down in large measure. Yeah.
No, the way Washington works, though, is whenever you have some sort of movement that fashions itself as radical, and insofar there's any element of a social movement to this at all, you're going to have to get assimilated to the ways of Washington, which means disappointments. The leadership of Congress is going to have to train these newly energized masses in the reality of how power works in the Potomac. What do you see, what do you imagine the reaction from the Tea Party types is going to be to this?
Well, we're going to find out. You know, if you ask me, one sort of touchstone of that is going to be the immigration issue. Because the Tea Party people seem to be quite nationalistic and adamant on closing borders. This is not the big business agenda, by and large. They don't like complete open borders. They don't like completely closed borders. They like sort of something in between. What they like is stateless workers who feel powerless and have no rights and can be easily exploited. And they don't want to close that down completely. So I think what we're going to see on the immigration issue is going to be an interesting look at that. One early sort of example, even before the election, of the assimilation was Rand Paul. Rand Paul, after he won the Republican primary, got a lot of publicity, and he went on Rachel Maddow and made kind of a fool of himself. And the things he said about the Civil Rights Act, he actually aligned himself with the notion that restaurant owners and entrepreneurs ought to be able to discriminate against African Americans and Latinos.
Which is the authentically libertarian point of view.
Which is the authentically libertarian point of view. Which is one of many reasons leftists should be very skeptical about thinking we can have alliances with and reach out to with libertarians just because there is some shared space on foreign policy and on the war on drugs. But who you're getting in bed with is really quite nasty. And so Rand Paul had a lot of negative publicity after that, and they took him down. The GOP establishment really, he stopped making media appearances. He stopped talking directly to reporters. And they had him in Mitch McConnell's office, and they reconfigured him, and they read him the riot act and told him what it's going to take to get the kind of money that you need to get to win, and he's been pretty tame and pretty safe since. I think that's pretty much a model for what you're going to see with these people. That's what this was about. That's what this really was about. The Tea Party people, even the meetings we went to, even, which really weren't, they had no idea what social movements are. They were tiny meetings where sort of authoritarian hacks, after complaining about how Barack Obama, the Marxist, is ruining the United States with big government socialism, would get into what this is really all about, which is boosting GOP turnout, and would inform the cadres that had come out there that, we've got this rhetoric that we're an independent social movement and all about that. Let's be clear. What we're really about is getting the vote out this November. And even if we don't have a Tea Party candidate, we want the Republicans in there. They're very dedicated to having Republicans in. That's really what this was about.
Speak with the author, historian Paul Street, author most recently of What's the Book on Obama?
What's that?
What's the book on Obama?
The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power.
Like you do some of the work of what the host is supposed to be doing. We have now a president and a now almost former Democratic majority in Congress that has disappointed mightily. It looks like we're going to have another set of disappointments coming. What's going to happen to our body and mind politic with this series of disappointments and alienation and absolute disengagement?
Yeah. It's just an absolute disaster. It's funny. I mean, you have to, when you talk about the Tea Party and Tea Party supporters, you have to just sort of distinguish between the inner cadre, which is really a small, tiny part of the populace, the people who give some money to it, who show up at the meetings and carry signs and carry on and so forth. And then this sort of broader part of the populace, some of whom are motivated to vote Republican, I don't know, it's 50% or whatever, who describe themselves as people who are sympathetic to or favorable to the Tea Party. And they have no idea what the Tea Party agenda is at all, and actually don't support certain considerable aspects of it. For example, they privilege federal job creation. Imagine that amidst 16% unemployment over deficit reduction. Actually, a lot of people who think they're Tea Party supporters or call themselves that don't support that agenda. So that's going to limit a lot of what they're going to be able to do.
A majority of Bush voters in 2004 thought he supported the Kyoto Protocol, so the American voter is not always connecting mind and finger.
Right, exactly right. Well, I mean, the basis on which people make voting decisions, which has to do with the fact that the elections push the issues to the margin in the first place, so what are they left to decide on? It's like who they want to have a beer with, or who looks good, or who they perceive as eloquent, or fits their identity, and things like that. People make voting decisions based on no knowledge, and I think the Tea Party in some ways was kind of like that. It was sort of a brand. It's kind of an amorphous default statement that I'm really sort of pissed off in America right now. And God knows there's all kinds of reasons to be pissed off. And there doesn't seem to be any particular institutionalized political expression giving voice in any kind of authentic way, certainly no progressive kind of way, to that anger that's out there. And that's a fail. That's this epic failure and irrelevance on what passes for a left in this country. That just sort of opens the door for whatever this phenomena is. What I would say with this election, when you look, Obama came in 2008 with this mandate amidst the unfolding of an epic crisis of neoliberal capitalism. I mean, this epic recession. This is no ordinary recession, and I think it's going to be with us for a decade, if not more. Significant majorities in both houses of Congress, and I mean nothing moved. I mean, there was an inadequate small stimulus that had some positive impact, and that was about it. And there was just this consistent abandonment of progressive promises down the line. Job creation, trade legislation, nothing on the Employee Free Choice Act, no real public works programs. I'm not sure a climate bill, which was pretty widely supported initially, even made its way out of committee. It's certainly nothing ever came up for a vote. And that's what happened with a Democrat in and Democrats in both houses of Congress. And now after this election outcome, with this increasingly far-right Republican Party entrenched in power, we really have to abandon all hope of moving the progressive policy ball forward in any way for at least 2 years. That's just over. I mean, you can just stick a fork in that as fire. So that doesn't mean people have to go light themselves on fire or anything, or jump out of windows or anything like that, but it means that it's sort of back to, it's a real rethinking movement and thinking what we're about, and maybe among other things we want to think about rebuilding a left politics beneath and beyond these quadrennial corporate crafted big money, big media, electoral, candidate-centered electoral extravaganzas that have been sold to us as, you know, that's politics, you know, that's the only politics that matters. Howard Zinn, I thought he said it very well. He used to say it again and again and again. It's not about who's sitting in the White House. It's about who's sitting in. It's sitting in the cafeterias and the workplaces, the communities. I mean, I hate to say it, but we're kind of right now, a lot of us progressives on the left, in sort of the state of individuals in the recovery movement to some extent. We are confronted with the necessity of the molecular rebuilding of elementary institutions and organizations of resistance. And there doesn't seem to be any progressive movement right now capable of pushing elected officials in any particular kind of way or of capturing popular anger in any particularly productive or useful way, and resentment abhors a vacuum. You know, I wanted Obama and the Democrats to win in 2008 because I thought it was critical for millennials, for 18 to 29-year-olds in particular, to get it, that the corporate imperial system is bipartisan. You know, their life experience was all the going on in the world and all the nasty stuff. And I'm sorry, I don't know if I can curse on the radio.
No, you can't.
all that nasty stuff that's going on in the world is just a function of George Bush in being in office. I wanted Obama to win in part because if he hadn't, everyone, particularly young kids, would just blame the wars and the bailouts and the 1% of the population owning, what is it, half the wealth. They'd blame it on the GOP. They need to have a life experience of the fact that the Democrats, that, as you put it very well before the election, that everything still pretty much sucks, you know, when JFK comes in and replaces Eisenhower. But I was very worried about that, too. That disillusionment process, which I think a lot of us on the Marxist or hard left knew was coming, because we know these politicians come in and they're beholden to that they wouldn't even be coming in if they weren't beholden to this very same parasitic economic interests that have a lockdown on policy in this country. But that disappointment does not inherently translate into anything progressive in the absence of institutions to capture it and give it some sort of meaning and democratic life and expression in policy-relevant kind of way, sort of floats out there. And some of it feeds, and you know, there's people ready, willing, and able who are very nasty and very dodgy and very racist and very nationalistic, like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and Dick Armey and other sort of architects of this far-right Tea Party phenomenon, ready to grab a hold of that. and put nasty uses. And we don't mobilize it. They will. They are. They have. And it's very dangerous. You know, it's Noam Chomsky's making analogies to Weimar Germany, you know, when only the fascists seem to be meaningfully, I mean, it's a little over the top because I don't go with fascism. But I mean, the sense that this resentment abhors a vacuum, and the Democrats and the what passes for a progressive movement in the structure, which seems in the Democrats' pocket, seems unwilling and or incapable of articulating in any particular kind of way. It's a very dangerous moment.
We've only got a couple minutes left, but sure. Just let's do a. It would be premature to do a post-mortem on the Obama phenomenon, but let's just look at. He came into office in 2008, you mentioned this earlier, with a large popular mandate, what felt to many people at the time like a realignment election,
yeah.
A large majority in both houses of Congress, yet, aside from that awful health care bill, they were pretty much unable to do anything on their agenda. The stimulus bill, okay, that was about the best thing they did.
Right.
It was flawed, but it was it kept us all from total collapse.
Correct.
But other than that, you know, just this constant failure. What looks to the outside as failure. This urge to compromise despite large majorities and would look like a mandate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, is it something about Obama's personality? Is it that the Democratic Party, I often like to put it, it's a party of capital that sometimes has to pretend otherwise for electoral reasons, so that's what makes them look weak and twisted, but in fact this is really their structural situation. How do you read this disaster?
Well, I think both of those are going on. Yeah, I do think that's absolutely right. I mean, we don't really have a two-party system. We have what Sheldon Wolin calls, you know, a one-and-a-half-party system, you know, in which all things considered, all things equal, the ruling class or the power elite that really selects and vets viable candidates in the first place, I think would generally prefer to have Republicans in office. The problems with Republicans every once in a while, just like Nixon and Bush Cheney, just go absolutely over the top, and it becomes sort of and the ruling class sort of gets it and sort of reluctantly understands that for a while the Republican brand has to be pulled back and the Democratic brand has to be pushed out front for a while, so they can get certain things from it. But it's very time limited, and it comes with all kinds of lectures that come to Democratic presidents and Democratic office holders that Republican office holders never get. You know, stay away from ideology, steer to the center, watch out for big government, watch out for deficits. Well, you know, Republican presidents throw deficits and big government, and they're driven by ideology.
Republicans are attacking the Fed now, which used to be like
yeah.
That.
Yeah, the Republicans never get that. And so it's very understood there's sharp parameters within which you can operate, and you shall go no further, and you cannot change the direction of society in any particular kind of relevant way. Now, I happen to think that Obama's personality, which going back to the beginning of his career was always about conciliation, that's how he became the editor of Harvard Law, was a deal he made with the Federalist Society, you know, pissing off all the liberals and progressives at Harvard Law School. And that was his career in Springfield and Chicago all the way up. So it's a perfect merging of the corporate neoliberal identity of what the Democratic Party which is really about. It's built to hold power for maybe one or two terms and do very little and then hand it back to the GOP, and Obama's personality fits that perfectly.
That was Paul Street. His latest book is The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power, published in September by Paradigm. He's now working on a book on the Tea Party with Anthony DiMaggio. You can find out more about Paul and read some of his articles on his website, paulstreet.org. That's one word, paulstreet.org. You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk sex with Cordelia Fine.
I believed my soul that inside every man there's a feminine. Yes, and inside every lady there's a deep manly voice loud and clear. Well, the cowboy may brag about things that he does with his women, but the ones that brag at his are the ones that are most likely queer. Cowboys are frequently secretly fond of each other. Yeah, what did you think all them saddles and boots was about? There's many a cowboy who don't understand the way that he feels for his brother. Inside every cowboy, there's a lady who'd love to slip out.
That was Ned Sublett, who was on the guest in this show several years ago, performing a wonderful song that he wrote that was made famous by Willie Nelson, called Cowboys Are Frequently Secretly Fond of Each Other. It makes a lot of people nervous when gender lines are blurred or crossed, and it makes a lot of people feel more secure when differences between men and women, or even infant boys and girls, are located in the body rather than experience. But as the psychologist Cordelia Fine shows in her terrific book, Delusions of Gender, most of these differences dissolve on close inspection. The differences between males and females are almost entirely explicable by how they're treated by families and society. In fact, those differences in treatment begin even before birth. Pregnant women who know the sex of their fetuses use different and value-laden words to describe their movements. Boys are vigorous, girls are calm. While those who don't know the sex of their fetus use far more neutral language. Fine is also a very good writer, and her book is a pleasure to read. Cordelia Fine, author of Delusions of Gender. Welcome, Cordelia Fine. I think what we've got facing this topic is what at least the financial economists call joint hypothesis problems. For example, what extent do these cliched gender patterns exist? To what extent, if any, do they correlate with brain activity? And to what extent, if any, do those brain patterns, are they hardwired, whatever that means exactly? And then, of course, there's a leap from scientific literature to the popular media, so we've got a lot of stuff to sort out here. But let's start out with some of the cliches about behavior. The classic one, men systematize and women feel. How do we know these things? Is this all the result of Borat's cousin, Sasha Cohen?
Well, how do we know these things? Do we know these things? I think part of the complexity with dealing with this issue is that people have a way of thinking about our behavior, which is that we have, you know, either a male brain or a female brain that produces a male mind or a female mind that will behave in particular kinds of ways all the time. And, of course, everyone acknowledges that, you know, there are some women who are sort of behave in a more traditionally masculine way, have more masculine interests. You know, it's not that there are zero female engineers, and sort of similarly, conversely, for men. And I think the even setting aside all the scientific issues to do with, you know, different brains and, you know, relationships between brain activity and behaviour, is that it really underappreciates the fact that our psyches aren't these sort of discrete entities that are just tucked into our head, but that are incredibly responsive to the environment around us. So what social psychologists find is that when people are thinking of themselves as male or as female, they will tend to behave in more stereotypic ways. They will show more stereotypical abilities. So their ability to read minds, for example, is enhanced if they're reminded of the social norm of being a woman and they also happen to be female. And also their interests become more stereotypic. And I have to say, this is, those sorts of data really come from studies of university students, so they are people who are at that sort of at the crossroads of their life, and it may be the case that older people aren't quite so malleable in their interests, but certainly it's an important period when people are making decisions, and being primed to think of themselves as male or female can actually push them in a stereotypical direction. So I think it's important to bear in mind that well, certainly there are gender differences in how people behave. It's very flexible, and it seems to be less of a case of the hardwiring of a male and female brain than a sign of the exquisite sensitivity of our minds to social cues about how we should and shouldn't behave. So when gender stereotypes are pushed into the psychological background, it's actually remarkable how similar the thinking and feeling and abilities of men and women become.
Some of these experiments, which find their way to the popular press, are done on kids who are just a few days old. There's this the classic line that boys like to look at mobiles and girls like to look at faces. Tell us about those studies that have established that alleged fact.
Well, the first thing to say is that there aren't studies. There's just one study. And, of course, in the popular literature, the results are presented in a very black and white way, sort of as you describe it. So boys like to look at mobiles and girls like to look at the face. And, of course, the sex difference that was found was much more subtle than that. It was a case of a matter of a few percentage points rather than, of course, all boys looking at the mobile and all girls looking longer at the face. The problem with this particular study, which has never been replicated and is actually not particularly consistent with the developmental literature, the larger developmental literature, is that the researchers just didn't make the efforts that are usually made to try and eliminate both the sources of noise that are a real issue in newborn testing, because newborns are not the ideal experimental subjects. They don't have very good concentration spans, for example. But also, most importantly, to eliminate what are called experimenter expectancy effects. So the idea being that, of course, whether you're testing the effects of a new drug or a therapy or simply running some kind of psychology experiment where the behavior of the experimenter can inadvertently influence the behavior of your participants, you have to do everything you can to prevent that from happening. So with drug trials, we have double-blind placebo effects. In this kind of experiment, you need to make sure that the person who's running the experiment, who in this case was actually the first author, so she clearly knew the hypothesis that she had in mind, does not know the sex of the baby. So in another similar experiment that was interested in babies looking behavior at a face, the great efforts went to the researchers went to great efforts to make sure that the experimenter could not possibly know what sex the baby was. And obviously in a normal maternity ward, there are lots of clues to that all around in terms of the clothing and the cards and the balloons and so on and so forth, and you know, even how the parents refer to the baby. These efforts weren't made in this particular experiment, so there is this very much a concern that because the experimenter was the face, she provided the face, so she could have, you know, looked with wider eyes, for example, at the babies. Babies like wide eyes. She could have waggled the mobile a little bit more, completely unconsciously, of course. But you know, newborns are drawn to motion. It's one of the stimulus characteristics they're most drawn to. And these things could have influenced the influenced the results. And so from my point of view, I sort of look at that study and say, well, look, before we start drawing any large claims about hardwired sex differences on the basis of this study, we'd want to repeat it with, you know, just the kind of very standard methodological procedures that would be appropriate for this kind of research. The research wasn't done well. The methodology wasn't the best. And I think for this kind of topic, where there are such high stakes, you need good experimental design.
And what about this line, the Baron Cohen line, that men systematize and women feel, or they're empathy machines? What's the evidence for this, if any?
Well, it's a very old idea, so it's a sort of modern jargon on the old idea of men as thinkers and women as feelers. A lot of Baron Cohen's data come from self-report questionnaires. So he has something called the empathizing quotient and the systemizing quotient, which ask questions like, well, I'm very good at understanding what other people are thinking and feeling, and I like to care for people. So that's the empathy quotient. Whereas the systemizing quotient, the questions are things more like, when I read the newspaper, I'm drawn to a list of information like football scores or stock share prices. I mean, it's sort of probably obvious to most people listening that self-report questionnaires are not really the best way to access information about what people's actual abilities. I mean, we wouldn't assess mathematical ability by asking people to rate how good they are at solving differential equations. And similarly, for example, empathizing, it's well known that there's a very weak or no relationship between how good people say they are at understanding other people's thoughts and feelings and how good they actually are. And when you take actual tests of performance, you actually put men and women in a room with another person and film them and then ask them to go through the tape of the interaction and at every point say, well, what was the person thinking and feeling there? And what were they thinking and feeling there? And you relate that to what the person actually reports thinking and feeling. You find that men are just as good at this as women. So clearly, if you're wanting to make claims about, you know, whether women are really hardwired to understand other people's thoughts and feelings, you know, you want to use a behavioural measure, an actual test of performance, rather than a self-report questionnaire, which is going to be very much influenced by very widely shared cultural beliefs about what men and women are good at and what they should be good at. In terms of systemising, it's a rather it's sort of a vague notion, and there's something a bit problematic about defining particular kinds of careers as being, you know, systemizing or as being empathizing careers. So, for example, nursing, of course, it does require a level of empathy, one hopes, but you also would want them to be competent as a medical practitioner as well. Likewise, for other kinds of professions. And there are certainly occupations that are more female-dominated that seem to fit in with the idea of systemizing, which is defined as the ability to understand the relationships between an input and then a function and an output. So hairdressing, for example, would seem to fit those criteria, but you know that sort of tends to be done mostly by women. Yeah, I'm not convinced by the hypothesis. Let's put it that way.
Also, on supposedly objective tests, like, say, math test, if you run the test, two different versions, tell one group of test takers that men do better on math and another group that say nothing to the other group, you get very wildly varying results, don't you? People are very suggestible to expectations and stereotype.
Yes, that's exactly right. So this large field of known as stereotype threat research shows exactly that. I think what's interesting is that when you dispel stereotype threats, so when you make the gender stereotype that, for example, women are not as good as maths, you make it either irrelevant by saying, look, on this particular test, no gender differences are found, or you sort of push it into the background, for example, by priming women to think of themselves, you know, not as women but as, you know, students at an elite university, then their performance improves. And, you know, comes back to my point I made earlier about the fact our psyches aren't these, you know, they're in the skull, they're protected from the physical environment, but they're not protected from the social environment, which can reach in and influence our abilities in quite important and significant ways.
I'm speaking with Cordelia Fine, author of Delusions of Gender. Onto the scene in the last couple of decades have come brain scans, which supposedly bring this whole pursuit of sexual difference to a whole new level of objectivity. What do these brain scans tell us, if anything, really?
I was smiling when you described them as bringing us to a whole new level of objectivity. I think that's part of the issue, is that people wrongly perceive that, you know, these colourful brain scan images as a sort of direct window into our mental activity, and there's people that appreciate the huge amount of statistical analysis that creates these pictures. So you're not actually looking at a picture of brain activity per se, you're looking at patterns of statistical significance at the end of a long chain of statistical analysis. What do these studies show? Well, I mean, I really began my research assuming that there were very much reliable and established sex differences in the brain, both in terms of the structure of the brain and in terms of men and women using their brains differently during particular kinds of tasks. And I hadn't really appreciated the problematic nature of this literature. So there are a few well-established structural differences in the brain. So, for example, the female brain on average is somewhat smaller than the male brain, but this creates a whole host of activities for investigating or being sure of other sex differences in the brain, because it's unclear whether you're seeing a sex difference or a difference between larger and smaller brains. So there might be engineering reasons for larger brains to be structured in a slightly different way to smaller brains, for example. And in terms of the functional neuroimaging study, so that's where you get people to perform a task in the scanner, and you're indexing indirectly the activity of the brain by looking at patterns of blood flow, for example. What the problem is that you do get reports of sex differences popping up all the time in the literature, but what seems to be going on is that often neuroscientists are running these studies and they'll test for sex differences as a default, because that's just a very natural and obvious and easy thing to do. And, you know, there's this problem in science of publication bias towards significant findings. So if they don't find a difference, then that will go unreported. But if they do find a difference, then that will not only be reported, but it may even become sort of the primary focus of the paper. So it becomes a report of sex differences in the brain. And this might be based on a very small number of men and women, so, you know, perhaps 10 men and 8 women or something. So we're talking about very small samples. Chances are these results are just spurious. They will never be replicated. There are lots of reasons why we have to be very cautious about spurious findings in neuroimaging data. But then what happens is that those studies will get picked up by popular writers who will then take them as evidence that, you know, we really are hardwired differently, and therefore boys should be taught maths this way and girls should be taught maths that way, and so on and so forth. And so these very impressive-looking brain scans and neuroscientific terms are being brought into, you know, educational courses for teachers, for example, and it seems terribly scientific. Neuroscience scores incredibly high on the scientificness hierarchy because it involves expensive machinery and white coats and so on and so forth. But, I mean, the release is just, these data are not the sorts of things we should be relying, basing educational strategies on. It really alarms me.
You say the larger the sample size, typically the less difference is found. Usually the studies that find large differences are very small samples.
Well, that's right. So one good example is this a very persistent idea, which is that the male brain tends to use just the left hemisphere, the left side of the brain, for processing language, whereas the female brain tends to use both sides of the brain. And this is a very old idea that used to be tested in not using neuroimaging data. But of course, when the neuroimaging technology came into use, people started to investigate this question using this new technology. And yeah, some studies do find support for this idea. So they found that, you know, women tend to show activity on both sides of the brain in language areas, and men just on one side. But, you know, other studies found the opposite. And when a neuroscientist called Ara Somo and her colleagues, They gathered together all the studies that investigated language processing and found out what their results were for, the differences were for men and women, and they put them together in a meta-analysis, which is, you know, a study of studies. And what this does is it gives you a much more reliable picture of the overall empirical situation, because it sort of weights the studies by their sample size. It's not putting undue emphasis on less reliable studies with small sample sizes. And if you look at their results, they did this meta-analysis twice, once in 2004 and then again in 2008 with the new data. And the first thing that's striking about the data is just the sheer variability. There's a lot of variability in what the neuroscientists are finding. But as the sample sizes get bigger, there's a convergence on zero difference, and her overall finding was that there is no sex difference in language lateralization. And I think that's a really good illustration of just how careful we have to be about a single study showing sex differences in the brain that's based on a small sample size.
And of course, even if they do find differences in the brain, there's no guarantee that those are like hardwired, as they like to say. They could be reflecting socialization.
Absolutely. Mark Liberman makes this wonderful point, you know, where else would we see the effects of socialization than but in the brain? And of course, I think this relates back to this point again about our minds perform in an interaction with the social environment around us. So, for example, I don't know if our neuroimaging techniques are really currently sensitive enough to be able to pick up these kinds of things, but, you know, when someone's performing a math test under stereotype threat versus not, well, that's going to have some sort of manifestation in the brain, but we wouldn't want to look at the woman performing maths under stereotype threat and compare that with men, you know, not performing under stereotype threat and say, well, look, this is, you know, these are hardwired differences in men and women's maths processing in the brain and, you know, therefore dot, 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 dot. Because, of course, how you process information is influenced by the world around, and, of course, that's going to manifest somehow in the brain, you know, at a moment-by-moment level.
I have a kid who's 4 years old, almost five, and I hear a lot from fellow parents, we tried to raise our child in a non-sexist way, but oh my God, you really do discover that there are major sex differences from birth, and, you know, despite all our efforts to overcome them, they're really there, you know, the trucks, the dolls, it's all predetermined. What do you say to someone like that?
Well, I've had this said to me many, many times, because it's nothing like telling a fellow parent that you're writing a book about gender to elicit exactly that response. And, you know, absolutely, I understand where parents are coming from, and I don't doubt the genuineness of their intentions to raise their children in a sort of non-sexist way. But I think there are two things to say. The first is that it's sort of, I think we have to be very careful. I don't know how to put this politely. You know, if you're talking about a sample size of one or two, and you're talking about differences between babies, it's not clear to me how, you know, very young boys and girls are sort of manifesting their boyness and girlness when they're basically just newborn blobs. So I do find that a bit strange. And but more generally, I think It's this interesting myth that we are actually raising children in a gender-neutral fashion, because from the moment children are born, they're obviously primed to learn, so and to prefer what's familiar. So you have babies born who already prefer the sound of the language that they've heard spoken while they're in the womb. You have babies who, by the age of 3 months, already prefer faces of the race that's most familiar around them. You have babies who prefer a female face if their primary caregiver is a mother. They prefer a male face if their primary caregiver is a male. So, you know, these are incredible learning machines that we give birth to, and then we surround them with information that, first of all, tells us that sex is the most important social division in the world, but then also provides them, just saturates them with information about what goes with being male and what goes with being female, and also all the cultural correlates of gender, as Sandra Benn put it. So it seems to me that there are very subtle sex differences in, for example, what boys and girls like to behave with prior to the age of about two, and it seems to me it's an open question whether this is really due to some sort of predisposition, or whether it's simply a fact that certain kinds of toys and colours and sort of metaphorical cues are just simply more familiar and therefore liked more by boys versus girls. And also we have to forget the fact that even the most well-intentioned parent has a head full of cultural assumptions about gender, even if they don't sort of consciously endorse them, that reams of social psychology data shows us will influence how we perceive our children and how we respond to them. So I really think it's an open question whether these very subtle differences that is seen sort of in the first 2 years of life are really to do with predispositions or just to do with the way the environments, the sort of physical and social environments that we provide for children. And then once children at the age of about two know which side of this very important social division they fall, you know, they've got that information, they know what goes with being male and what goes with being female, and children are sort of they're self-socializers. So this idea that children will behave in gendered ways because their parents kind of enforce it just isn't sort of psychologically accurate. Children are sort of motivated themselves to behave in ways that are appropriate for this tribe that they now understand that they belong to. And I think it would be amazing, given the environments that children grow up in, if they didn't show gendered behaviour after they realised what sex they were, you know, even setting aside any issues of biological predispositions.
You show throughout the book that, you know, all the evidence for biological basis for sex distinctions are flimsy, to put it kindly. Yet there's a tremendous desire, especially in the popular press and the popular audience, but even among scientists, to make those distinctions biological. Why do you see this tremendous urge to biologize stuff that is really quite deeply social?
I'm not sure, and this is a question that really, I feel that there's probably a whole other book to be written on this topic, and in a sense perhaps even, dare I say, a more important book than the one I've written. I mean, I got the very strong sense. I came to realize when I was writing my book that this was a book that has been written many times in the past and will be written again many times in the future. It's just, you know, I almost suggested that as a subtitle. I did suggest it as a subtitle for the book, which was, of course, instantly rejected by the publisher. But, you know, it was very depressing to realize that one hypothesis falls and then another one is simply there to take its place. And, of course, I think it's important to sort of debunk the contemporary scientific claims. But there's this sense that, well, you know, others will come to take their place. So I think, yes, well, why is it that we are so quick to draw these premature conclusions? Two things that occur to me are first of all, that, you know, social psychologists have identified that we have what's called a system justification motive. So there's something very comforting to us about the idea that there's something natural and inevitable about the status quo. And this is comforting even to people who might not do quite so well at as a status quo. So there's something psychologically beneficial about feeling that it's not just simply unfair, it's that there's something, some sort of natural, inevitable reason for it. So perhaps that goes some way towards explaining the appeal of these kinds of theories. And secondly, I think we have a difficulty seeing inequality. So it's kind of interesting to look back at the arguments that were made in the past and you know, sort of go back a century or so when, you know, women weren't even entitled to go to university, and you have these sort of feminist scholars saying, you know, is it possible that women aren't be giving their, given their full opportunity to develop their talents, and the sort of tentativeness with which they suggest that there might not be equality of opportunity just seems incredible now. But I think generally we have this blindness to how how we have inequality of opportunity. And I think now, of course, there aren't institutional barriers to sex equality. The legislation forbids it and so on. But we still have this quite substantial psychological inequality of opportunity that I think we don't, that is sort of profoundly under-acknowledged. So I think perhaps it's just this sort of general problem of not seeing how psychological and social forces prevent or stand in the way of equality that leads us to the sort of biology as fallback position. Well, you know, we can't blame society anymore. Those scapegoats have been eliminated, so we can't find anything outside the brain, so let's look inside and see if we can find the answers there.
That was Cordelia Fine, author of Delusions of Gender, recently published by Norton. Fine is a researcher at the University of Melbourne in Australia. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of Stereolab's Silver Sands, from their new album, Not Music, which may be their last, since the band is now officially on hiatus. Till next week, bye.